Good morning. September's almost over. Yes, Mr. Bruce.
That's something you shared that it's encouraging to everybody, I'm sure.
Yes.
Nathan brought to my attention, and I've seen it as I looked at Facebook with some of the postings, but there's one person that he's associated with before he was a Christian showed no interest in God, didn't come from a background of church, and just recently the young man's been posting a lot of scripture, and it appears that he's being pulled towards Jesus. I don't know if he's made a commitment to surrender to Jesus or not, but it's encouraging that there are people that are being touched by the change in my son's lives.
Absolutely.
And that's the good news of Jesus.
Yes. We can use encouragement in this world, can't we? Every chance we get. Good to hear that. It's good to have Megan with us today. Been a while since she's been in Salem. She's always welcome. We're studying in Luke chapter 11 this morning. And last week, we had just started this section of chapter 11 where Jesus gets asked out to dinner. That's usually a pleasant experience, I would think, but not for everybody here. And so it was a Pharisee that asked him out to dinner. And we've noted here last week that the Pharisee was amazed that Jesus didn't perform the ritual washings that he anticipated that he might do. And we don't have a record here of him saying anything actually about it, but Jesus knows what you think. You want to be careful what you think when you're around Jesus, because he knows. He sees it all. And the Lord responded to his thoughts. He said, "Now do ye Pharisees make clean the outside of the cup and the platter, but your inward part is full of a word which means robbery and wickedness. Ye fools, did not he that made that which is without make that which is within also? But rather give alms as of such things as ye have." And we noted last week, this is a continuation of his without and within comparison. So, give unto God that which is within, and behold, all things are clean unto you. And this precipitates a series of verses here where Jesus is being very judgmental about the Pharisees. With no apologies. So let me read through this, and then we'll talk about some details. "Woe unto you Pharisees, for ye tithe mint and rue and all manner of herbs, and pass over judgment and the love of God. These ought you to have done, and not to leave the other undone. Woe unto you Pharisees, for ye love the uppermost seats in the synagogues and greetings in the markets. Woe unto you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye are as graves which appear not," so they're not openly visible, "and the men that walk over them are not aware of them." And of course that's a big deal to the Pharisees, because one of the prime sources of corruption or uncleanness is contact with dead things. Some years ago, I showed you a picture of a modern Hasidic Jew who was on a plane wrapped up in a bag. You remember that picture? because the plane took off and went over a cemetery, and he was concerned about contacting, it was a clear bag, but he was all wrapped up. He was concerned about contacting uncleanness by passing over that grave. So, a big deal here, right? So, to us, we don't consider ourselves to be unclean because we walk through a cemetery. But Jesus says, you're hidden. You're the deadness that you conceal is as though you are a hidden grave that people are walking over. So a serious concern to them. Then answered one of the lawyers and said unto him, Master, thus saying, thou reproachest us also. And he said, Woe unto you also, ye lawyers, for you laid men with burdens grievous to be borne, and ye yourselves touch not one of the burdens with one of your fingers. Woe unto you, for ye build the sepulchres of the prophets, and your fathers killed them. Truly ye bear witness that ye allow the deeds of your fathers, for they indeed killed them, and ye build their sepulchres. Therefore also said the wisdom of God, I will send them prophets and apostles, and some of them they shall slay and persecute. That the blood of all the prophets which was shed from the foundation of the world may be required of this generation. From the blood of Abel unto the blood of Zacharias, which perished between the altar and the temple. Verily I say unto you, it shall be required of this generation. Woe unto you, lawyers, for you have taken away the key of knowledge. Ye entered not in yourselves, and them that are entering in ye hindered. And as he said these things unto them, the scribes and the Pharisees began to urge him vehemently and to provoke him to speak of many things, lying wait for him and seeking to catch something out of his mouth that they might accuse him. And there at last is the end of chapter 11. 54 verses, right? But we're not done talking about it yet. There's still more here. So, we have two groups, actually three groups, that are mentioned in this passage. He talks of Pharisees, he talks of scribes, he talks of lawyers. Now, in Matthew's parallel account, the term lawyers doesn't come up. And it appears that this is another group that's associated with the Pharisees, as the scribes were not a separate sect of Jews. The historian Josephus speaks of three primary philosophical / religious sects of the Jews. There were the Sadducees, there were the Pharisees, and there were the Essenes, that he categorizes as the main divisions. The Sadducees were connected with the priesthood and the temple worship and ceremonies. They come into the discussion in the New Testament, at times questioning Jesus and trying to criticize him, but it's noted that they didn't believe in the resurrection. They don't believe in spirits or an afterlife. The Pharisees, of course, we see them most often, and the Essenes are not mentioned by name in the New Testament, but they would certainly have had contact with John the Baptist because their ascetic lifestyle in some ways corresponds to his, and also geographically the area that they tended to congregate in, the area what came to be the area that the Dead Sea Scrolls were found in, coincided with where he spent a lot of time. So undoubtedly there was contact, but they're not mentioned by name. Anyway, the Pharisees get the brunt of Jesus' criticism in the Gospels. It's interesting to note that the Pharisees are the forerunners of the modern rabbinic Judaism that we now see in the world. The Sadducees largely died out when the temple was destroyed. After all, if you're a priest and there's no temple, you're kind of unemployed. And so they, as a group, haven't survived. And the Pharisees and their teachings sort of morphed into the rabbinic Judaism that we have today. So the word Pharisee has become, in the Christian world, of course, almost a synonym for hypocrite. So that's kind of what comes to most people's minds. And certainly hypocrisy is one thing that Jesus criticized them for. But I've often been challenged to try to understand more fully why it was that they garnered so much of the negative attention of Jesus. Let's look here at some of the specific criticisms that he leveled against them. The one here that opens is a criticism sometimes the concept of hypocrisy gets sort of fuzzy in our minds. Our word for hypocrite comes from the Greek, and originally a hypocrite was one who was an actor on stage, so one who pretended to be something that they weren't. And so the first criticism that Jesus levels here is that they're concerned about an outward appearance, but not concerned about an inward reality. Now, that's not strictly speaking hypocritical. That's just inconsistent. It's a focus on what's not important. They're suggesting that reality is what's out here. As long as I take care of what's out here, then it doesn't matter. Jesus says, well, actually, no, Jesus, that God is concerned about the internal. He's not just concerned about what you are on the outside. And in fact, he suggests if you will fix the outside will follow. So the basic problem there is a total misunderstanding of what God's interested in, right? And that's something we need to know in life. What is God interested in? What does he want from me? And so that's the first thing that he critiques about them. Secondly, he says, you tithe mint and all manner of herbs and pass over the judgment and the love of God. Okay, this again is a question about what does God care about? What's important? What should be the highest priority in your mind? He said, the one ought you to have done, and not to leave the other undone. So again, this is not a picture of hypocrisy. It's a picture of wrong emphasis. A picture of stressing the things that are not of the greatest importance. What else does he criticize them for? Well, in verse 43, he says, woe unto you Pharisees, for you love the uppermost seats in the synagogues and greetings in the markets. Uh, How would you describe that problem? What is their problem?
Self-centered.
Self-centered?
Oh, and even more self, what's the term? Aggrandizing. I'm not sure if I got that word right, but elevating himself. Not just focused on himself, but specifically elevating himself above others.
Okay. What about the placement of love in that picture? You know, when you're thinking about, yes, we can talk about it as being self-centered.
What you love is yourself most.
But the focus is, what do you love? What do you pursue? What do you rise to? What do you joy in? You know, there's a sense in which you could say somebody knows that they can't be the center of attention, but they can cultivate a love for praise, a love for being the uppermost. That's what I long for. That's what I value. That's what I esteem. And it seems that God is concerned about what we love. What do you set your heart on? What do you allow yourself to glory in and embrace? So there again, it's not just simple hypocrisy. It's a much deeper criticism than that.
And again, this is getting to human nature. It fascinates me that large, powerful men physically are so prone to caring about what others think that they're scared to do the right thing, even though you have these football players, these professional sports people that are very capable physically, but they care so much about what other people think. And then the movie stars and the rock star people, they are so caught up in what people think that it cripples them in the decisions they make and not being true men of character. And people tend to lift them up and they care so much for that glory, for the present, and don't think about eternal in most cases.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, we can think about people around us in our lives that we interact with, that they seem to care more about what people think of them than stepping up and saying, this is right or this is wrong. I'm willing to die on this sword because I understand it's right in the eyes of God.
So you see that in our world, don't you? You see this problem. Why did Jesus single the Pharisees out for a typically human problem? Why are they getting so much criticism?
Because they were supposed to be representing God to the people. They were the leaders of the speakers for God.
Okay, so there's another aspect of the picture here. The Pharisees were the perceived leaders in things religious and spiritual. And they were quick to denounce anybody who didn't agree with them. So they elevated themselves to a position of being the ones who spoke for God. And so that's an important thing to realize when you think about the criticism they got from Jesus. They were in direct competition with the Word of God and claiming to have God's perspective, God's position. And it was important that he made the distinction. I am not like you. The things that you are purporting to be God's will are not. And this is an example of one of the things that is a part of your mindset. You love the uppermost seats. You love the public greetings and salutations. You love the respect that you get from other people. And that's where your love is. And he says, woe to you.
Keith, I agree with what Laura said, and you touched on it. I think the other thing was to separate himself from the Pharisees. Because when somebody's new to the scene, the question is, who are you? Are you just another Pharisee? Are you just another part of the religious establishment? And he made it fairly clear in my mind on what he said to the Pharisees and how much he upset them in front of everybody. But people see, hold on a minute. This person's ethical, he's honest, he's genuine, he's not like the Pharisees. And so that's refreshing when you see the acting of the Pharisees and their evil intentions, to see somebody that's coming on the scene that is in a position that will question them and contradict them. It'd be encouraging to me. I know in life it is, when somebody else steps up and says, no, I disagree with this. We're not going to go along with this policy. It's like, oh, great. There's somebody else that agrees with me. I'm not alone with this. Even though if I need to be alone, I will be, it's encouraging that there's somebody else that sees this or is willing to go against the flow.
Uh-huh. Yes, thank you. I do want to stress the huge difference in approach to truth that Jesus takes from the Pharisees. And we can really see that very well as history unfolds. I've shared this before in the past, but as Pastor has demonstrated, we don't always remember what we talked about last week. So this has been a while since I did this, and you may not remember. So we have a lot of evidence about what the Pharisees thought in detail, because the movement that became Rabbinic Judaism wrote it all down. And one of the tenets, the prime tenets of the Pharisees was that, in fact, not only did the Jews have the written law, the Torah, but as well, there was an oral tradition that was handed down from teacher to teacher from the time of Moses. And one of the things that distinguishes them from the Sadducees and other groups is they believed in this oral tradition. Well, about 200 AD, they decided to write it down. And so we have the Jewish document called the Talmud, which is quite lengthy. Which records in a form their oral tradition. Now it's an odd form, an interesting form. It usually exists in the form of two rabbis debating with one another about a topic. And so you'll start reading it, and so Rabbi Joshua says this, and Rabbi Elias says this, and you get this back and forth conversation going on. But in the process, they expose what they believe and what they think. And so when I originally prepared this, we were studying in Matthew, I think, and Jesus makes a really strong statement in Matthew as well, here in Matthew 23. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you are like unto whited sepulchres, which indeed appear beautiful outward, but are within full of dead men's bones and of all uncleanness. Even so ye also outwardly appear righteous unto men, but within ye are full of hypocrisy and iniquity. And you may remember that that word iniquity is literally lawlessness. So imagine the magnitude of this accusation. Here's the Pharisees to come to be rabbis, who purport to be giving the law of God, right? They're the ones who are passing it down. Jesus said, you are full of lawlessness. How can that be true? How can that be so? They pretend to be the ones who keep the law most carefully, most faithfully. That is quite an accusation. Well, there's an interesting passage in the Talmud, which I think helps illustrate the stark difference in Jesus and rabbinic Judaism. If you want to look it up and read it yourself, it's in the tractate Bava Mezia 59b. In this, we have Rabbi Eliezer, who witnessed the destruction of the temple and smuggled his teacher out of the besieged Jerusalem in a coffin in 70 AD. He's arguing over the purity of an oven with his fellow rabbis. So one of the big topics of argumentation with the Pharisees was purity. How do you maintain purity? How do you become impure? What do you do about it? These kinds of things. Ovens and vessels generally transmit impurity. So this idea of impurity, if an object becomes impure, then anything that touches it's impure, and it has to be cleansed, except there are some things which can't be cleansed. But anyway, there are categories of things which by their nature transmit impurity. One thing, for instance, that didn't, as I remember, were vessels made of stone. So if you made your plates or your pot of stone, then it couldn't transmit impurity the way a clay pot could. However, a broken vessel couldn't. Now, don't ask me to explain how this all works or why. It's kind of like, why do some of the Amish not have air in their tires? They just do. That's how it is. So the rabbis had come up with some reasoning that broken vessels don't. Well, there is this hypothetical oven of Acnai, and it's made of broken pieces of vessels that are cemented together. So an oven can transmit impurity, but what about an oven that's made of broken vessels? Okay. Is it in the category of an oven, or is it in the category of broken vessels? I can see right now that you're going to be wanting to read all the Talmud. So if a man made an oven out of separate coils and put sand between each of the coils, such an oven, Rabbi Eliezer declared, is not susceptible to defilement. While the sages, the other rabbis in his circle, declared it is susceptible. On that day, Rabbi Eliezer put forward all the arguments in the world, but the sages did not accept them. Finally, he said unto them, if the halakha is according to me, and halakha is a word which just means the correct interpretation of the law. Okay, so if the correct interpretation is according to me, let the carob tree prove it. So he points to a nearby carob tree, which then moved from its place 100 cubits. Some say 400 cubits. But the sages said unto him, one cannot bring a proof from the moving of a carob tree. Okay, so moving carob trees don't count. Then said Rabbi Eliezer, if the halakha is according to me, may that stream of water prove it. The stream of water then turned and flowed in the opposite direction. They said to him, one cannot bring a proof from the behavior of a stream of water. Said Rabbi Eliezer, if the halakha is according to me, may the walls of the house of study prove it. The walls of the house of study began to bend inward. Rabbi Joshua then rose up and rebuked the walls of the house of study, saying, "If the students of the wise argue with one another in halakha," he said, "what right have you to interfere?" In honor of Rabbi Joshua, the walls ceased to bend inward, but in honor of Rabbi Eliezer, they didn't straighten up, and they remain bent to this day. Then said Rabbi Eliezer to the sages, "If halakha is according to me, may a proof come from heaven." Then a heavenly voice went forth and said, "What have you to do with Rabbi Eliezer? The halakha is according to him in every place." Then Rabbi Joshua rose to his feet and said, "It is not in the heavens." Deuteronomy 30:12. What did he mean by quoting this? Said Rabbi Jeremiah. He meant that since the Torah has already been given on Mount Sinai, we do not pay attention to a heavenly voice. For you have written in your Torah, decide according to the majority. Okay, so like I said, this is not the form of communication that we're used to, this kind of setting where these rabbis are arguing back and forth. But the conclusion of this little section is that God's will isn't determined even by a voice from heaven now, because he's already given his voice in Torah, and he requires the rabbis to interpret it, to come to a conclusion, because it has to be interpreted. So, effectively, God is no longer allowed to comment on what his word means. Find that shocking? Yeah, it is shocking. This is the philosophy that Jesus is facing. What is the Word of God? Jesus says, "I am the Word of God."
And the Holy Spirit would lead us into all truth. So there's going to be a continuation of guidance from above.
And so one of the characteristics of these passages in Talmud is sometimes they use a device to supposedly give feedback on what God thought of what was going on. And usually the device that they use is Elijah, who, you know, was taken up in a whirlwind. So he didn't die a normal death, and somehow he has the ability to communicate back and forth. So you ask Elijah, Rabbi Nathan met the prophet Elijah. He asked him, "What was the Holy One, blessed be he, doing in that hour?" The hour of this discussion. Said Elijah, "He was laughing and saying, 'My children have defeated me. My children have defeated me.'" So to our ears, these are shocking things. It's amazing. And yet, if you have any doubt that that's what Jews actually believe, I have a passage here from online, where a person, apparently Pamela, is reflecting on Jewish thought. And she says, "There's a famous story in the Talmud that describes several rabbis arguing about whether a fellow's oven is fit for use. In the course of trying to prove this point, the rabbi who holds the minority opinion attempts to convince his colleagues that he is correct by calling upon God to support him. After the river runs backwards and a voice calls out from heaven that he is correct, his colleagues scoff, saying they do not determine legal matters based upon heavenly voices. They quote God, who told Moses and the people of Israel that the law is not in heaven, but in their own hands." Okay, now if you go read Deuteronomy 30:12, you realize that this is an interpretation as well. It's not at all clear that, yeah, this is what God intends. The story concludes with God laughing and declaring, "My children have bested me." This is one of my favorite images of God, the parent who is delighted upon realizing that the next generation has finally grown up to be independent adults who are indeed smarter and more capable than their parents. So, Do you understand a little better the energy behind Jesus' condemnation of the Pharisees? We're talking about a worldview, which is a world apart. A worldview which says the law God has given it into our hands, and it's our responsibility to interpret it, and the will of God is determined by what we decide as a majority. Jesus, by contrast, says, I am the Son of God, and I have come to do His will and to reveal it to whoever will listen. Those two opposing approaches are not compatible. So, in light of what history has revealed as the direction that the Pharisees were headed and the foundations that they were based on, perhaps you understand a little better the degree of criticism that they received from Jesus. They claimed to be representing to the world the very will of God. Jesus had a very different message on that topic.
Keith, it's interesting too, a lot of times people fight against legalism and say, well, you don't want to be a Pharisee and just be legalistic. There's a difference between legalism and following the law. Because Jesus doesn't condemn the law here, he actually condemns them for being lawless.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yep, the Pharisees, to be a catch-all, you see, you take the energy of Jesus' criticism of them, and then you transfer it into your own platform to criticize whoever you want. Because if you can associate them with the Pharisees, then you're right in calling them bad names. Right? And so that's one reason I want to look very carefully at what it is he's criticizing them for. It's not these general broad labels of just hypocrisy or legalism, which really is something that gets interpreted into their accusations and not specifically his words. But what is it he's concerned about? Well, this is something that you can take to heart. He says, you don't love the right things. You love something which isn't even valuable, for one thing. You don't have the right priorities. Justice and the love of God, you neglect. You're concerned about outward appearances and not inward realities. And yes, God wants you to be clean, but He wants your heart to be clean.
So Keith,
yeah.
Again, because I've just recently run into it again, someone told the story of there was a wicked man who fell in love with a lady, and she was righteous, and so he had a mask made of a saint, and he put that on so he could woo her, and then of course to live according to live up to it, he did good things, and later in life someone meets him that knew him from before, and so they're going to unmask him. But because he has lived this way for so long, when they do take the mask off, his face has grown to the mask. And that, I see that in the, and Kierkegaard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He was a big influence on a lot of people. I hear him quoted a lot, and it was, you do something and then you become it. But Jesus is pointing at, it starts at what you are. And, if we focus on, God, help me to be the kind of person that, instead of, help me to be patient and help me to you know, as you pointed out, with the fruit of the Spirit, like, okay, I'm gonna be loving and long-suffering and have self-control. It's help me, God, transform my heart until I am the kind of person who does those things. It's a tree producing fruit, as opposed to fruit changes the tree into something else. So it's about integrity. It's Jesus is pointing out, you know, you just have a mask on, but underneath you're something else. So anyway, these ideas are still floating around in church circles and, you know, devotionals or sermons that we read and hear, and Jesus is pointing to reality.
Yes. So, you know, from a philosophical standpoint, there have been lively arguments about the equivalent of which comes first, the chicken or the egg. But you know, it's still true that in our path of life, there is this process of self-understanding, understanding what you really are. Especially when we're raised in the church, we know what we're supposed to be, right? And it's easy whenever somebody asks you, well, do you love everybody? Well, yes, I got to, right? And it is a real revelation sometimes when you wake up to the fact of, well, by nature, I don't. You know, that's just, as a matter of fact. And so we have to address the reality of what we are, and sometimes we discover areas where we are deficient, and we have to focus on those. But what changes in your heart is the determination to follow the good wherever it goes, right? So that's the difference. It's not just trying to paste on a new face or paste on an attitude. It's about a serious pursuit of the good and understanding what it is. And understanding what about me is keeping it from being demonstrated.
I was wondering earlier when you were talking about the Pharisees and their love for a place of glory,
yeah,
how things are so interconnected. And I think, like you said, we determine our heart, we will follow the good wherever it leads, we'll follow Jesus wherever my understanding of him leads me, and I want to keep pursuing better understanding. But with that issue, I'm thinking that, you know, you never, at least in my experience, you don't get away from the temptation to like the feeling of people appreciating what you do or what you bring, what good you bring to the world. But it's that the moment you start to feel that feeling, if I understand correctly how to deal with it, it's like, Lord, I want your will in my life. And I'm glad if this is a blessing to them, but I'm right back at your feet, and where do you want me next? Or, you know, that constant relationship with him that rejects just glorying in that feeling. You have it from time to time.
Absolutely. There are all sorts of forces in this body of flesh which are natural. You don't choose them. They come of their own accord. But the difference that Jesus gives us is those things we don't cherish. We don't make them our objective.
And you recognize how empty that is. That, you know, he doesn't lead us that direction because it's empty. There's nothing lasting and fulfilling in that. And if you pursue it, you always have to have more. It's never. And you can see that in the lives of the poor people like you who make it big, whether it's sports or Hollywood or wherever. You see that it's so, so unfulfilling and empty.
Right. And so then you get into these big debates and conflicts about, did I get enough credit or glory for what I did? Mm-hmm. So, you know, who's the greatest of all time? And these huge fights about who's the greatest. Never mind the fact that everybody knows my name and I'm famous, but am I considered the greatest?
Screaming for privacy.
Yeah. Yeah. So it is an issue of the heart. It's an issue about what you love. We all understand the positiveness of being appreciated for what we do. If you work hard to do anything in life, it's fulfilling when you realize somebody appreciates this, and especially if they express it, right? But in following Jesus, we do what is right, whether it's recognized or not, whether it's expressed or not. And our fulfillment, and this is something you have to work on. This is something you have to train your mind to. My fulfillment is in knowing I'm pleasing Him.
That also evens out when you crash. You know, it's like, okay, that's human. That's going to happen from time to time. I didn't do very well that time, but he's okay with me. And nobody, people, they appreciate if you're willing to say I'm human. You know, even if, yeah, you failed on the issue.
Keep that something on the order of what responsibility would you accept, would you receive no credit? Just, I never heard it put that way, but it caused me to stop and ponder.
Sure. Yep.
You said, Dan, that quote,
I don't know if I have it exactly, but something like, what responsibility would you accept for which you would receive no credit?
So responsibility as in job or duty or whatever. What project would you take on if there were no possibility of getting any credit for having done it? Yeah.
I think part of that's maturity. Because when I was younger, that meant more to me. As a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've gotten older.
So this is quite a contrast, the way that the Pharisees are going versus the truth that Jesus offers. So then with regard to the lawyers, which I say I think we should understand is perhaps a subdivision of the Pharisees, he says, in verse 46, you laid men with burdens grievous to be borne, and ye yourselves touch not one of the burdens with one of your fingers. Okay, sound like government? Yeah. Universal health care, except we have our own. And on and on you could go. So here again, this is not technically hypocrisy. This is about manipulation and control. This is controlling other people with restrictions that you're not willing to bear yourself.
We have an example of a governor who likes to impose higher taxes.
Have you removed any of yours yet, Bruce?
I thought about it.
Yeah. At any rate, it's a highly unsavory thing when you think about it, to be governed by people that know all the rules and use them to their own benefit, but expect you to keep them as though you didn't. So he has some very specific criticisms which go way beyond hypocrisy. He says here in verse 47, "Woe unto you, for you build the sepulchres of the prophets, and your fathers killed them." Okay, so what's the point here? Well, there are still the remains in the Jerusalem area. There are the remains of some ancient grand structures, which were basically sepulchres, mausoleums of the dead. It has been the case in a wide variety of cultures to honor the dead, the famous dead, with great monuments. And that's usually considered in your community as a noble thing to do. So, you know, it's like building a monument to George Washington. What a noble thing to do. I understand that there's some that want to do one to the current president as well. But Jesus points to this publicly acclaimed kind of activity and saying, well, you're voting with your fathers who killed them. That's, you're in the same boat. The apple hasn't fallen far from the tree. So it's a deflation of something which normally would have generated civic pride and importance in society. Not something you're likely to be guilty of, I don't suppose, literally, but anyway, you can see what's going on there in that conflict. Very well. Thank you for your attention.
My His yoke is easy, His burden is light. I found it so, I found it so. I found it.